Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
Welcome to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham on AM 770 KTTH. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Know Your Risk Radio is brought to you by Bulwark Capital Management, helping families navigate the ever-changing and often treacherous financial markets. Know Your Risk Radio starts now. Here's your host, Zach Abraham.
All right, welcome back to the show, and thank you so much for joining us. There's a little bit to talk about today, and we're going to cut this short. So this is going to be a two-segment show because we've got a special guest, which we've been teasing for a while, Jonathan Tepper, the author of the new book, Myth of Capitalism. And look, just pay the $13 on Amazon and read it because it is so prescient. And he's a brilliant guy. And we've talked a lot about a lot of this stuff on the show before. The era of the new robber barons, how that's impacting wage growth, how we have the biggest wage gap between the rich and the poor in this country since 1929, at the top of the roaring 20s, the ramifications that that is having, both socially and financially and economically. And he just does a brilliant job of adding really in-depth research behind those ideas and showing that, yes, indeed, this is an issue. And we didn't get a chance to talk about it in our discussion, but it was funny enough. He was telling me this off air was in the last week, he got contacted by some high ups in Amazon that asked him to take the section about them out of the book. And, you know, he's a very polite guy, and he politely refused and just said, no, I'm sticking with what I'm writing. But I just thought that was interesting that it got their attention, that they took the time to call him and say, this isn't fair. You need to take a Why would Amazon care about little old Jonathan Tepper? Now, he's written several books. He's definitely got a bigger profile than me. But little old Jonathan Tepper and what he has to say about the myth of capitalism, if it wasn't something that was ringing true. And like I've said on the show before, I don't fault Amazon. Okay, I don't think that they're any less of an incredible company, but they're a monopoly. That's their whole business plan, right? Their whole business plan is to use all their different businesses to subsidize each other and walk into an industry and undercut everybody in price. And I'm sorry, but that's called a monopoly. So anyway, fascinating interview, but let's get into the market update because we've got lots to discuss. Now, sure enough, going back a couple weeks, I said that I was going to break my rule. I think this was in December. And I said I was going to break my rule. I was going to make a market call that I thought markets were going lower. They did. And then we've had a sharp reversal since December 24th. And I think we've talked about, you know, some of the implications here. And on the past shows, talking about The day after Christmas, the 26th, we saw the S&P up 5. We saw the NASDAQ up something like 6 and change. And everybody was cheering that. Oh, here we come, roaring back. And I just said, hold on. 80% of the times we've seen averages up that high have been in bear markets. Okay? So the way we look at it right now is that I think that this is the beginning of a bear market. Now, this could take a long time to play out. If you remember, the great financial crisis did not happen in 6 months. We had countrywide went bankrupt at the end of 2006, went under beginning of 2007. And that was kind of the first, you know, the first tremor, if you will. And then it filtered down. But that whole thing took 2 years to play out. I think that we've started the process. Now, we're not betting on it. And we're not trying to time markets. We say this all the time. So, and I was having this conversation. I was telling this to a client this week, and they said, why don't we just sell everything and get out? And I said, no. That would be timing markets. We're not doing that. What we see is a period of very high valuations, excessive optimism that's based in no fact. We see economies around the world slowing down. We see the Federal Reserve constantly jawboning. They see the weakness in the economy. They're pulling back on their interest rate hike plans. We're going to follow our nose, but we're not going to try to play it perfectly. This isn't a game of perfect. This is a game of using this opportunity to reduce our exposure. Because if we miss out, especially those of us, now, if you're at home and you're 35 years old or you're 40 years old and you're saving for retirement, you might want to take a little risk off the table just to give you some cash to buy at lower levels, which I think you'll see. But I don't want you trying to trade in and out. Even we don't do that. Okay. This is not about market timing. What this is about, though, is protecting gains, conserving capital. And we're saying that as money managers, fiduciaries of our clients' money, If the worst result from doing that for us is that we're up 7% this year and the market's up 11, that's a result I can deal with. Now, am I going to be happy about it? No, but we're financing retirement. We're not a hedge fund. We're not trying to beat the market. Now, we did last year, little plug, but that's not the attempt. The reason we beat the market too is not because we are aggressive, it's because we are conservative. Okay, so this goes right into risk management. Okay, everything we're talking about here is not, oh, go short, sell everything. Blah, blah, blah. That's not responsible, right? Look at Warren Buffett. He's not selling stocks right and left, but he's been building up a giant pile of cash, right? There's a defensive posture there. And so we just want to manage that risk because markets don't go up forever. So let's get into what's going on. Now, like I said, this looks to us like a classic bear market rally. And one of the reasons I say that is because yesterday we hit a perfect 50% retracement of the fall, right? We fell 20 from top to bottom. As of yesterday, we'd recovered 10% of that. That's 50% retracement. Today, Friday, as we're recording the show, market's up solidly. I got to pull it back up here. I don't know how I got off that. But we were up. The highs were right around 350. But there's some really interesting action going on. One of them is the VIX. The volatility index is still hanging in there at 17.5. When you see a run-up like this, the VIX should get absolutely pummeled. Why is it not? Because it's not buying it. Right. It's still saying, no. Remember, the higher the VIX is, that tells us it's the market or investors need for downside protection. And if people were buying this, if everybody thought that this was real, you'd see the VIX dropping like a rock. OK, on top of that, volumes have been really light. Once again, like I've been telling you for the last 6 months, you're being given gifts here. OK, don't get greedy. Do not get stuck in that frame of mind I'm going to hang in there till I recover the highs. That is nuts, okay? That is insanity thinking. What you need to do is you need to look at the crazy volatility we had at the end of last year. You need to look at this ramp up, and you need to see it as confirmation of, hey, this might be a good time to de-risk a little bit, because I know a lot of you out there have way higher percentage of stocks than you should have, and you do it because bonds are yielding nothing, okay? This gets us right back into our talk about there is a safer way to go about doing this. We don't want you reducing your bond holdings. We're 10 years into the longest bull market in U.S. history. You guys are tired of hearing me talk about it. But you've been given a gift here with this surge in prices, and it allows you to get off at higher prices. You know, it allows you to put some more cash on the sidelines without taking a hit. Now, the thing I think is interesting here is that we hit the highs of the day on nonsense, on fake rumors about China trade resolutions, and the markets have just taken off. Now, the interesting thing that I think, though, is that we're already seeing that starting to fade here as we get later in the day. Where we finish today, I think, is going to be really interesting. And I can't reiterate this enough, guys. If you've been listening to the show, hopefully you enjoy it. Maybe you listen to it purely out of enjoyment, but take this opportunity, right? If the worst thing that happens to you next year is you make 6 or 7% instead of 11 if the market goes up that much, That's not a game-ending result, guys. That's not a game changer. What is a game changer is a 40 or 50% loss. I personally think we're starting that process. Okay? Now, we're not going to go all in. We're not going short. We're not trying to time things because I could be wrong. I've been wrong before. Right? Another guy asked me, well, if you think it's so, why aren't you just short? Why aren't you max short everything? I said, well, A, I'm a fiduciary of other people's money. That wouldn't be prudent. That wouldn't be wise. The other thing is remember, investing like golf, it's not a game of perfect. Okay, don't get caught up in trying to catch every run. But this is just a great time to be defensive. Now let's talk about other things we see going on. Look at that. The VIX is almost even on the day and the Dow's up 300 points. That should tell you all you need to know. Okay, There, no one's buying this. And it's on light volume too, for the most part. But what we're seeing here is, I think, just a classic bear market bounce. It's a short covering. Everybody that was short and that stayed short has been absolutely pummeled over the last 3 weeks. And I think what you're seeing here in the last few days is just capitulation because the market has gone straight up. This is what happens in bear markets. Now, to get specific about individual stocks, another bad sign. We had Apple come out and miss earnings. We had Netflix, another big market leader, come out and miss earnings. They beat on subs but missed on revenue. Their growth rates are slowing down if we compare them to last year. We're seeing all the signs here, guys. And it doesn't mean we know what's going to happen in the market next week. It doesn't even mean we know what's going to happen in the market. It's 11:30 today. I can't tell you what I think we'll continue to fade here into the close, but I can't tell you that. But it's not what we're trying to do, right? What we're trying to do is use this as a preview. Okay, you've gotten a nice preview. You're 10 years into the longest bull market. One of the biggest amplitude moves from top to bottom, 330%. The S&P has rallied in the last 10 years off the bottom. Okay, this is a time to be defensive, not time things. Conserve capital. And if you want to know how to do that, if you want to know how to get more conservative, lowering your fees and increasing your security, 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK. We can do a phone consultation. I can meet you in person. You'll meet with me. You won't talk to somebody else. We can even do it over email, okay? Because we do. But don't be tricked by this. Do not increase exposure here. Play defensive. And if you don't know how to do that, if you're not getting this guidance from somebody else, call us, email us, go to the website, knowyourriskradio.com, bulwarkcapitalmanagement.com, and get a second opinion before it's too late. You got an opportunity here. Take it. And stick with us, because up next, we've got our interview with Jonathan Tepper, the author of the new book, Myth of Capitalism, which is a must read, and I believe it's a must listen to interview.
Do better in bull markets. Do better in bear markets. Pay less fees in all markets. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management. You can subscribe to Zach's free newsletter, The Bulwark Insider Report, at knowyourriskradio.com.
Many people with near or over $1 million in assets will mistakenly pay more in taxes in a long-term care situation than it would have cost them to set up an insurance plan to pay for the care needed. Due to recent changes in the Pension Protection Act, these new asset-based plans guarantee a tax-free benefit for long-term care and pay you back with interest if you never use it. But most importantly, it's about having a plan. All your children have to do is carry out your wishes, and you're not a burden on them. That's why I love the advice we got from Brian Ott and 525 Advisors. Brian's asset-based class is coming up Monday, January 28th in Bellevue. This class is aimed at individuals and couples who have accumulated close to or more than $1 million in assets and may be considering to self-fund long-term care costs in the future. Learn why that's not the best idea. Seating will be limited for this special asset-based class, January 28th in Bellevue. Reserve your spot right now, 525longtermcare.com, 525longtermcare.com.
Volatile markets are never fun, but it provides the opportunity to see exactly how much risk you're exposed to. Hey, it's Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital and host of Know Your Risk Radio. So what do you do? Look, safety doesn't have to mean lower returns. By using our bond replacement strategy, our clients have actually increased their returns while being insured against loss and all the while lowering their fees. Call now and get your free copy of our brand new booklet, Common Sense Investing, 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK. Or go to knowyourriskradio.com.
And I got to tell you, you have to read Zach's brand new version of Common Sense Investing. You'll learn how to protect your retirement against loss, but still participate in market gains. Call now, get your free copy, 866-779-RISK. That's 866-779-RISK. Or go to knowyourriskradio.com. Bulwark Capital Management is a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
All right, welcome back to the show, and thank you so much for joining us. And without further ado, we got a special guest. We've been teasing this one for quite a while. He's a busy guy, but he's made time to be here with us on the show, and I think he's got some really poignant, very applicable and very important things to discuss. And so I'm really excited to share them. So Without further ado, I want to welcome Jonathan Tepper to the show, the author of the new book, Myth of Capitalism. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Okay, so before we get into the book, which, by the way, I'm a huge fan of, and I can't recommend enough, and we've plugged it on the show before, but you have a fascinating upbringing. Can you just give us a short synopsis of what your life was like growing up? I find it fascinating.
Sure. So I had a relatively odd childhood, but I think most people aren't aware that they have an odd childhood until they get a little older and start meeting other people who didn't have the same childhood they did. And I think that started happening to me sort of late in high school and in college. But my parents were Christian missionaries, and they were Presbyterians. They went to Spain in the 1980s, and back then Spain was much poorer and had the highest rate of heroin use in all of Europe. The neighborhood I grew up in, San Blas, there were about 10,000 gypsies. They sold a lot of heroin. There were also a lot of Spanish, non-gypsy dealers too. And that from the balcony of my a little apartment that my parents had rented, you know, we could see addicts sort of going and buying heroin in the open fields every day. And then my parents wanted to actually work with student chaplains, and my father had studied economics at Cambridge and got his MBA at Harvard, and so he thought he would be a student chaplain, and instead my parents ended up trying to help the heroin addicts in the neighborhood, at first sending them to other centers in the north of Spain, and then after a while working with an Australian missionary couple, realized that they needed to start a center in Madrid, and so my parents started the drug rehab in 1985 with one heroin addict. And then, you know, if you go fast forward to today, it's now in 25 countries and has over 2,500 addicts in the program. And the program is all run by the former heroin addicts themselves. And so almost all my best friends growing up, brothers and sisters, were the addicts in the program. And in 1980s, Spain was unique because the U.S. had a huge AIDS crisis. Most of the early cases were almost all of gay men. And then in Africa, there was a big AIDS crisis as well, but that was almost all heterosexual sex. And Spain was the exception, where almost all of the AIDS cases were among intravenous drug users. And so, you know, some of my friends had been in jail, and you'd have, you know, one or two syringes being shared by 250 men shooting up in the prisons. And then they share needles on the streets. And so that's sort of how, you know, almost an entire generation of heroin addicts ended up being HIV positive. And most of my friends died of AIDS in the late 80s and early 90s. And so that was a very odd childhood, but it's sort of what I grew up with.
Wow. So that, that's definitely got to shape your perception and shape your outlook on a lot of things. And then I also know that you went on to study at Oxford, correct?
Yes. So my parents were very sort of bookish, and they would read to us at the breakfast table and at dinner table. And so that sort of carried on into the way my brothers and I studied. You could describe us, I guess, as nerds. We all graduated with highest honors. My brother taught himself calculus and trigonometry just by reading books. And I ended up he sent me his college textbooks. And so I could have skipped almost 2 years of college, but I didn't in the end. But it meant I could do more advanced and interesting studies when I was at college. And so I ended up getting a Rhodes Scholarship my senior year, and went off to Oxford after undergrad.
Well, it's fair to say that our academic careers are quite a bit different. So little bit different there. Okay, so I love that, because one of the things that I've learned, I've spent my whole life in finance one way or another, and one of the things that I love is people that have, well, with the name of your company, Variant Perceptions, right? Different upbringings, different outlooks on life, and the insights that gives them. You know, you can't fabricate that. It just gives you a different look at things. Would you say that that's impacted? Well, it's had to, right? It's impacted the way that you look at the world, the way you look at economics, markets. I would imagine pretty much everything.
Yeah, so I think that when I look at my parents, for example, when they wanted to start the drug rehab center in the mid-80s, you know, sort of 83, 84, before they actually started it, the mission had no interest in doing it and thought that it would be a failure and a disaster. And, you know, they just went ahead and did it on their own. And I think that, you know, sort of seeing, you know, my parents sort of go out there and do something new and different or challenging was inspiring. And I think that, you know, certainly most of the time when you're trying to do something new and interesting, no one's going to roll out the red carpet for you. And I think the same thing's true in finance, you know, particularly if you're sort of doing loads of research and you're early to a trade or you have a different view of variant perception, you know, you're not going to get patted on the back at first. You'll only look sort of smart or make money later. And, you know, what we've really tried to do is to, you know, be very data-driven. So we're not, there's no point being sort of contrarian just for the sake of being contrarian. But if you have very solid data and solid tools that allow you to have a different view, then, you know, you can sort of go out and, you know, beat your own path, and then, you know, people will follow.
Yeah, and I this is kind of a, you'll have to forgive me, it's kind of a awkward, clunky transition, but that the first time I heard you talk, now we'll get into the book now, but the first time I heard you talk, and for those of you just joining us, we're with Jonathan Tepper, the author of the new book, Myth of Capitalism. But the first time I heard you speak was on Real Vision. And I was fascinated by your take on something or on this whole topic that you wrote the book on, monopolies and the lack of wage increases with the, you know, economy and markets going to the moon, supposedly. And we're not seeing the wages catch up with things. And one of the things that fascinated me, I was fascinated with about your story was that unique way you grew up. And like you mentioned, watching your parents go out and do something kind of outside the norm. I came up in a similar fashion. We weren't, you know, treating AIDS patients in Spain, but, you know, I grew up in an entrepreneurial family. So I had, you know, I think that that kind of bakes into you that willingness to cut against the grain. And then, you know, we started our own firm 3 years ago. But when you're willing to go outside the, you know, outside the norm and outside the typical channels, it definitely impacts the way you see things. And so I hearing that from you when I first watched that first interview on Real Vision, I thought, you know, that's interesting because you were speaking. Now I'll get to it. You were talking about this whole wage issue, right, and this gap between the rich and the poor. And we started looking at this about 4.5 years ago because it was fascinating to me that we were seeing this, you know, run up in asset prices and the economy recovering and wages not participating. And truthfully, we probably spent too much time because it wasn't really investable, but it was just it was intellectual curiosity for me that drove me to sit there and go, why is there this disconnect? And we just kept coming back to modern monopolies and what I'd referred to on the show before as the modern age of the robber baron. And then you come along with your book and, you know, and I don't have anywhere near the research background that you do or capability. But I heard your book and you were putting data to the conclusions that we had come to through your research ability. And I just found it fascinating that so many people were looking past this. So I've kind of shared how we came to it and why I was so enthralled when I first heard you speak to it. What got you going on this? What kind of tipped it where you went, something's off? What sent you down this path?
Well, so it's quite interesting that you know, you intuitively felt this before you read the book. As I've been traveling around the U.S. and speaking to people, you know, sitting on planes and chatting with people, what's very interesting is everyone tells me that they intuitively feel that about their own industry. You know, I sat next to a doctor who was telling me how now that the city that he lived in had only one hospital system and they were buying up the independent doctors' offices. And so it's quite interesting that even when people haven't done necessarily the research, they see it in their daily lives, which is why it resonates when they do. The way that I came to the research, you know, one was a sort of, you could call it a very detailed approach, and then another one is a very high level one. The detailed one is basically that for my own business, I co-founded it with some colleagues. We build leading economic indicators, and these some of them relate to growth. So, you know, is the U.S. going to be growing or not in 6 to 12 months? We also have inflation leading indicators. One of them is a wage leading indicator. So it should tell us whether workers are going to get a raise 15 months from now or not. And that indicator for the last 6-7 years has been going up quite quickly. And you would expect that if that were correct, that we would be seeing wages go up, and we weren't really seeing them at all. And if you take our wage leading indicator, it also leads corporate profits and return on equity. The biggest expenditure that companies have is labor. And so if workers aren't getting a raise, what tends to happen is that companies then have very high profit margins and high return on equity. And if you're an investor, this matters an enormous amount. You know, if forgetting the sort of whether it's just or not for workers get paid, this has a tremendous impact on your whether stock markets should be at all-time highs. You know, if you have now a permanent plateau where corporate profit margins are high and going to stay high. So I was trying to figure out, is this a structural thing or is this a cyclical thing? And I really approached it trying to figure out why our leading indicator was broken, why it was telling us that wages were going to be going up and they weren't. So something was clearly broken in the U.S. economy. Jeremy Grantham, the great investment strategist, said corporate profit margins are the most mean reverting series in finance. If they don't mean revert, then something's broken with capitalism. Mm-hmm. Because if you have a business that has high corporate profit margins, I'm going to want to compete with you. I'm going to go want to, earn some of that money myself. And so competition should erode returns. So that was sort of like the very detailed approach. And then at a higher level, over the last couple of years, there have been writers, an economist, Thomas Piketty. His book sold 1.5 million copies. A lot of people who are not economists may not have read it, but Piketty has sort of been extraordinarily influential, and a lot of the sort of thinking people, intelligentsia, have sort of read Piketty and commented on him. And he was arguing that capitalism itself had a fatal flaw, that capitalism itself would bring about its own destruction. And he argued that when growth is very low, as it's been recently in some of the developed countries, that returns to labor would go down and returns to capital would go higher. And so that would explain why workers weren't getting a raise. And, I was sitting in pubs in London and have a beer with my friends and debate Piketty, and it just made no sense at all to me. I pointed out that if returns to capital were high, that some other capitalists would come in and want to compete with them. Like, you don't just end up with high returns on capital because of low growth. And right. So I thought this issue of returns on capital and return to labor is sort of central to the investing world. It's central to understanding what's going on with workers. And it's more central, I think, to the ongoing debate that people are having about capitalism. And so I thought this is worth dedicating some time to.
Yeah, well, and I'm certainly glad you did. And I want to get into the book here, but I also want to make it clear that, and this is true for me as well, but in no way, shape, or form are you a socialist. This is not an attack on capitalism at all. In some ways, I see it as almost a clamoring or a plea for a return of real capitalism. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. So I think that what we need is more competition, more capitalism. The English writer G.K. Chesterton said the problem with capitalism is not too many capitalists, but too few.
Right.
And I think that the problem with monopolies, obviously, is there are too few capitalists, too few people competing. And I also think that, if people who love markets and capitalism don't fix the problems, other people who don't like capitalism are going to be doing the reforming. And so I think it's incumbent on those of us who like free markets to make sure that markets, in fact, are free. And that I really wrote the book, to try to make sure that we can keep markets as open and free as possible. So I very definitely am a capitalist and a free marketer. And I think that what's interesting is that the left seems to like the book. The right, some parts of the right seem to like the book. And then they both hate different parts of the book. So I don't think anyone, everyone sort of likes some parts of it and then hates other parts. And I think that's probably then means that I've done a decent job.
Yeah, no. If everybody's agreeing with you, right? You've probably not done as well. And if you're disrupting both sides of the aisle, then you're probably onto something. But wanted to jump into some of these topics here. But before, and I've just got, I'm trying to sift through this pack of things that I want to ask you. So forgive me if I'm taking the machine gun approach to things here. But let's set kind of a primer or a parameter around what are these companies? Let's address some of the monopolies we see and kind of lay out for us just a basic construct. I've spoken about it before on the show, but just from your lips, a basic construct of the book, the companies you're focused on, and kind of the role that they're playing in this whole thing.
Certainly. So the central thesis of the book is that competition has been declining over the last 20 to 30 years. And the main reason for this is a series of merger waves where if you think of the Sweet 16 or the World Cup, you start out with about 16 teams, you go down to 8 and then 4. And what's happened is in many major industries, we've ended up with fewer and fewer players. And some industries are monopolies, often local monopolies, but other industries are oligopolies, meaning that you have, you know, three or four players, and it's very easy for them not to compete. It's very easy for them to collude on price and output. And if you think about, you know, the average American's life, whether it's broadband internet, 75% of Americans don't have any choice when it comes to high-speed internet. If you think about sort of the American healthcare system is certainly one of the most messed up in the world. There are certainly obviously very good elements to it. But then when you consider that, you know, in most states, that basically two insurers control, you know, 60 to 70% of the market, and you have very high concentration on the health insurance side, then, you know, 90% of the urban hospital markets are highly concentrated. And when you look at, you know, the fact that many of the drug companies, there's very little generic competition, even when generics could be introduced, you know, or even the FTC has sort of signed off on drug companies buying generics. If you think of like people buying houses, have to buy title insurance. You know, they're in most states, they're an oligopoly, but generally you have one or two that dominate. And by law, you have to buy title insurance, even though it's actually a completely sort of irrelevant and unnecessary thing. You know, even the Government Accounting Office pointed this out nowadays with modern records. And so there's just an enormous amount of lobbying and regulation that goes on to create these monopolies. Some industries do have natural monopolies. Most of these do not. And I point out in the book that one of the things that creates more and more concentration often is government regulation. And the more messed up markets are, the greater the incentive it is for companies to spend money on lobbying to get the regulations they want. So broken markets create broken politics. And if you look across the U.S., in cities, people tend to have more choices. You have more companies competing. But as you go to smaller cities and then rural areas, you often find, you know, fewer and fewer alternatives when it comes to jobs. And so higher levels of industrial concentration lead to a few things. One is sort of lower wages because companies basically can dictate to workers. They often have power to force employees to sign non-compete agreements, even though most of these are not actually enforceable in most U.S. states, but they still, the average person doesn't know that, and then they're signing them. And then they also force people into binding arbitration agreements, you know, which sort of sounds good, except for the fact that, you know, most binding arbitration outcomes are favor companies, and the average person then, you know, can't afford to fight them. And arbitration basically rolls back decades of, you know, gains for workers' rights, you know, to make sure that they're not being stiffed on their pay and things like that. So that's on the worker side. Then you also find that, you know, monopolists tend to spend less in terms of R&D and innovation. So we've seen a collapse in terms of half of the public companies. In the last 20 years, you've seen the number of public companies collapse by half. We've also seen a collapse in terms of the private startups. So the exits have remained constant. You know, companies go bankrupt or shut down, but we've seen fewer and fewer new startups. And if this was the U.S. population at large, This would be very concerning if, you know, you had almost no new children being born and the old were dying off. So it leads to less economic vitality. And it also leads, you know, to squeezing of suppliers. So big companies can force their suppliers to be paid less. And so that's why the dominant companies and industries often have higher profit margins, and that's really the result of market power. So I go through all of this in the book, and you know, those are some of the central themes of the book. I also provide a bit of history in terms of how did we get here, and you know, what are the potential reforms.
Well, yeah, the and for those of you just joining us, this is Jonathan Tepper, the is with us today, the author of the new book, Myth of Capitalism. Can't recommend it enough. And then one of the questions, I think, as I've walked through this with some of our clients, they've said, okay, well, we've got all these excess profits. Where are they going? And I sit there and I go, well, you know, probably one of the biggest places they're going is to share buybacks, because there's, you know, and I'm sure you've, I think everybody in this industry has or should read the Alchemy of Finance, but you know, you see reflexivity in all these things. And I was explaining this to somebody that works for us on the way up to this to do the show today, was that you've got this reflexive nature, right? The bigger they get, the more intertwined they are with government, you know, politicians and government agencies, and the more, you know, power they wield, and you know, equals higher profit margins, and that profit is not being distributed to labor, because it's, like you said, it's a non-competitive environment. And a lot of, at least from our vantage point, a lot of those excess profits are just rolling into stock buybacks, which further, right, it's another continuation of that reflexive cycle that's going to people that own stock. We know that, you know, 50% of stocks are owned by the top 1% here in the United States. And so that capital isn't leaking down, right, like it has in the past. Do you think do you agree with that statement? Do you think stock buybacks are a direct derivative of this whole situation that you're outlining in the book?
So I agree with you on that. I think that, you know, when I read articles on share buybacks, or I see people mention it on Twitter, often they think that that's the problem. And I'd point out that, you know, my co-writer and I, she wrote that chapter, Denise Hearn, we point out that share buybacks are a symptom. They're not the disease.
Right.
You know, companies basically have abnormally high profit margins due to industrial concentration and less competition. And that's what means that they end up with, you know, abnormally high profits. So they're ending up with more cash. And they have to do something with that cash. They choose not to invest less, but they could then dividend it out or do buybacks. Lately, they've preferred to do buybacks versus dividends. And so what you end up with is very high levels of buybacks, because these companies have a lot more cash than they need, and they just pay it back to themselves. And so, you know, you used the term earlier, robber baron. I discuss in the book how the term robber baron came about in the late 19th century in the U.S. because they imported it from, you know, medieval Germany. And basically in the Middle Ages, you had barons, and if you wanted to cross their lands, people had to pay essentially a toll to the baron. But the barons often did nothing to keep the toll roads up and, you know, to provide a better service. It was just a naked transfer of money from the peasants to the barons. And in a way, today, with many industries and companies, what you have is a toll road of daily life. And so people end up paying a lot more for medical care than they should. They end up paying a lot more for broadband than they should. And these are effectively toll roads, you know, from the average person to monopolists. And then all that money, you know, it's essentially a very efficient form of regressive taxation. That money has to go somewhere. And so it ends up going into share buybacks and being sent off to shareholders.
Yeah, I think anybody that's had the unfortunate experience of dealing with Comcast on a regular basis could really identify with that, because and truthfully, as anecdotal as this is, that was one of the things that got me going down the road. I was dealing with setting up high-speed internet and a new phone system for our firm, and I was just, I'd never, you know, Comcast presented its problems, but the lack of apathy, or excuse me, the extent of the apathy that they showed about our concerns or our problems was just, it was dumbfounding to me. And that was one of the things that got me going down this path 3 or 4 years ago, was sitting there going, and then we started looking around and I realized we had no other option based on where we were geographically. And I just thought to myself, this is a monopoly. So if for the folks out there, and Comcast is one of the exclusive broadband providers, phone providers, cable providers here in this area in Seattle, and I think everybody can identify with that experience. You know, you call them with a problem and they don't care. Right? It's because they're not worried about losing you.
They have local monopolies, and in almost all these cases, they've happened through acquisitions, and then often there are laws in the U.S., for example, that limit any competition with the local cable company, and so it's not like you could raise some money and go lay down some fiber optics, right? Like in most of the towns and cities in the U.S., there are laws that prohibit competition.
Now, hopping to another part, and by the way, that was the third question I had coming up for you, was the discussion about the robber barons, because I was throwing that term around lightly. I didn't even know the historical context. I knew the time frame of, the early 20th century and late 19th century. We had the robber barons here in the United States, Carnegie and I'm blanking out, but, several of those guys. And I was referencing that. I didn't know. I thought that was a fascinating story, fascinating read in the book about the the origins of that term. But now for the listeners out there that think that this is more of a benign problem, that it hasn't reached a malignant stage, and this is another reason why I think they should read the book, is in chapter 10, we talk about income inequality in the book, and you've got a chart in there that was just, again, fascinating to me. That income inequality, and these are things that we know, but just to see it on a chart, everybody, get an idea in their head of where we're at and why I say that I believe that this is a malignant problem, is we've got income inequality that you show on that chart now in the country that's equal to the height of it in 1929, which I believe was the previous all-time high in terms of income inequality. Now, the chart's in your book, so I know you agree with it, but do you also agree with the statement that this is no longer a benign issue? That this is a malignant issue that needs to be dealt with and soon? Would you agree with that, or do you think that's a little too hyperbolic?
No, I do agree. I think that what's interesting is there was a chart we have in the book, and it came from Bridgewater, but it shows that after these extremes in inequality, what you often end up with is a big rise in populism and social unrest. And I think that if we don't fix these problems, what we're going to end up with is a much greater social upheaval or unrest and rise of populism. And we're seeing this in many more countries. And obviously, it's not entirely, it's not sort of monocausal. It's not like inequality itself is the only thing driving it. Clearly, there are other things, but it is certainly a powerful driver. I think if we want to make sure that, we end up with a better society for everyone in terms of economic dynamism, if you're an entrepreneur or a businessman, if you're, higher wages, if you're a worker, more competition is going to be better. And so I think that that is one of the key things that we need to do. People feel that the system is rigged against them. And the fact that Trump is president and Bernie Sanders almost beat Hillary Clinton, and she had the entire Clinton machine and Democratic Party in her favor, tells you how great the discontent is with the establishment. And, both of them on the campaign trail said that the economy was rigged against people. People loved them for that. They voted for them for that reason. And it tells you that the average person doesn't really feel that things are working in their favor. And, my fear is that you're going to end up with sort of more radical and even more outsiders in the next round because people aren't happy, with the outsiders enough. And people voted for Obama, I think, because he was an outsider. He essentially had almost no experience, and he was perceived to not be part of the Democratic establishment. And so, if Trump's an outsider right now, just imagine what kind of even greater outsider we might get the next time around if people don't feel that the problems are being genuinely solved.
Well, yeah, that was something. I can't remember who said it, but they were like, if you're exasperated with Trump, wait till you see who they elect next. And I completely concur. It's one of the things, and not that it keeps me up at night, but if we get the antithesis or the opposite side reaction in terms of the next presidential election, and we get a Trump on the left, Things could get really interesting really quick. Now, another one I wanted to look at, too, that I thought was a really, really interesting point in Chapter 4, talking about how this latest run-up, and I believe, if I'm getting anything mixed up here, let me know, but talking about how in this recent, you know, not only have we not had the wage growth that typically accompanies the growth in asset prices and markets and the economy over the last 10 years, but we've largely had a missing out, or people in rural areas have sat this out. And that is eerily, you know, hearkening back to the previous period of time where we had record wage gaps or record wealth inequality. That was a very similar story in the 1920s, wasn't it? We had this booming age, the roaring 20s, but those in the rural areas back then, they missed out as well. It was not an even distribution at that point as far as the economic growth. Would you concur?
Yeah, so that was certainly something that you saw back then when a lot of the growth went to the very wealthiest, the owners of capital. But I think that one of the interesting things that you've noted is right now, there's quite a lot of concentration in U.S. agriculture. It's become extreme. So, you know, you're basically down to about four major players in the meat market, and these players don't really compete with each other at the local level. So the sort of chicken and hog and sort of beef markets are essentially divided up locally, where the very large companies aren't really competing to, you know, bid for the meat. They actually are done under production contracts, and so you basically have four companies completely dominating and actually having, you know, pretty much outright monopolies there. And then on the sort of seed side, you know, there have been like mega mergers last year that were consummated, you know, and now you basically have three companies globally controlling the key seeds and fertilizers for American farmers, you know, and not to mention, of course, the grain traders. There are four grain traders. They're known as the ABCDs, which is sort of Archer Daniels Midland, Bungie Cargill, and Louis Dreyfus. And so it's no surprise that farm incomes and farm bankruptcies, you know, so bankruptcies have been near record highs. You know, there was only a peak in income essentially with the commodity boom in 07, 08. But that's another thing that's basically decimated U.S. farmers. So farming has gotten more productive, but none of that is actually accrued to the actual farmer. It's almost all accrued to the sort of large companies. And I think that's another reason why rural America is suffering.
Right. Okay, so now switching gears a little bit, and I'm kind of throwing myself out there because you may not agree. You and I have not discussed this before the show. So, but what role, when I look at this situation, Jonathan, I can't help but to think that the Fed actions, especially in the last 20 years, mainly in the last 10, that's when it's been the most extreme, that Fed actions have played right into this and exacerbated this issue. And the reason I believe that is because if we go to a period of time where, you know, Druckenmiller refers to it as the hurdle rate of low interest rates. But if our response coming out of a financial crisis like 08-09 is to drop interest rates to zero and have the Fed start buying up assets, and at the same time we tighten credit, credit requirements. I mean, isn't that kind of, if you were going to design a system, or if you were going to take action as a Federal Reserve or a central bank of any economy, I mean, isn't that kind of exactly what you, now I'm not saying this was their intention, but isn't that exactly what you would do to widen the wealth gap? Because if interest rates are zero, if that hurdle rate is zero, and we tighten credit restrictions at the same time, the only people that can take advantage of free capital are the people that already have it, right? The people that already have big balance sheets. And then, so therefore, you've given a structural advantage. You know, the biggest balance sheet wins. What are your thoughts on that?
So there's a couple interesting issues that you raised there. One is that we've seen essentially a almost 40-year bull market in yields. So the 10-year yield and policy rates were extraordinarily high in 1980-81, and they basically just come down. You know, and for the last couple of years, have been hovering essentially between sort of 1.5% and 3% on the 10-year. When you look at it, basically it means that borrowing becomes less costly, and companies naturally have increased their levels of debt. And so companies use debt to buy each other often. So you could argue your argument that the Fed has helped contribute to this problem, I think, is accurate to the extent that companies have been able to borrow more freely to buy each other up. And I certainly think that has something to do with it. In the second chapter of the book, I discuss the oligopoly problem. So, you know, people often say that, you know, a monopoly is bad, but we don't have to worry because there are actually three or four companies and they're all competing. But what actually has sort of happened is that, you know, you have very few companies and oligopolies don't tend to compete with each other. And so they often tacitly collude and agree not to compete. And sometimes this is spoken, you know, which is illegal. Sometimes it's not. It's sort of tacit collusion. And that comes from the oligopoly problem. But what's very interesting is that that's driven by real rates. When real rates are very low, companies have a greater incentive to collude. And that's what the research shows. When real rates are very high, they have less of an incentive to collude. You know, the opportunity cost for colluding is higher. So real rates actually do matter quite a lot for collusion.
Well, and I, again, there's another thing that I haven't talked to you about. So if your research disagrees, feel free to say. But one of the things that we've also thought about too is that if you drop borrowing costs down to zero, one of the things that, you know, one of the ways that small businesses compete with the big guys is we're more nimble, we're more efficient, things of that nature. The lower the interest rate, the less impetus or the less focus there needs to be on efficiency. At least that's a conclusion we came to. Do you agree with that? And B, do you think that is a factor in play, that if we raise interest rates higher, it actually gives the smaller guy you know, a better chance to compete just because the focus on efficiency, and now businesses are going to be more hesitant to borrow capital because they've got to get a, you know, whatever business they start has to get a greater return on capital to be able to service the debt. Do you see a link there?
So I did not really look into that. But what I do look into and point out in the book, and there are quite a lot of different studies showing that, you know, mergers are supposed to create efficiencies. Right. And in theory, putting two companies together, they get better. But actually, what tends to happen is that companies just get pricing power. And so the mergers themselves don't create greater efficiency.
Okay. So, and I don't want you to give away the conclusion of the book. I think it's something that's really seminal, and I think it's a really prescient topic and phenomenal research, and I want as many people to educate themselves on this as possible. But where do we go from here? What type of resolutions do you think are possible? What type of actions do you think need to be taken? If you were king for a day, where would we start, and how would you attack this, and what tactics or what strategies do you think need to be employed, whether they're legislative or whatever that is? How would you deal with this?
So the last chapter of the book has a series of specific proposals, and I think that there are a few things that we can do. One is to prevent any future mergers that make markets less competitive, not least because many industries actually do have considerable barriers to entry. Some are real, some are regulatory. And the second thing we need to do is to break up past mergers that made markets less competitive. There are plenty of mergers that were allowed to have been allowed to happen that have reduced competition and were completely unnecessary. So I think that those are the two main ones. But also, competition isn't just about antitrust, you know, and mergers. It's actually about barriers to entry. And I point out that, you know, what we need is not sort of deregulation or more regulation, but rather more sensible regulation that is intended to, promote competition. And so the example I use in the book is Glass-Steagall was a law that was passed to reform the banking sector in the 1930s, and that worked very well. It was 35 pages long, and for decades we had new banks cropping up, serving local markets and smaller businesses.
And hold on, I don't want to interrupt you, but you skipped over 35 pages long. This wasn't one of these 2,000-page pieces of legislation, right?
Oh, exactly. I mean, believe it or not, the original Social Security Act was 35 pages too. And, you know, that is fairly simple goals, fairly simple means. And the problem with Dodd, as you pointed out, Dodd-Frank was, you know, the act passed to reform banks after the crisis was 2,200 pages. And we've had almost no new banks in the decade since. So clearly, you know, we need to have better rules and regulations that allow us to you know, have more competition. So those are, that's if I were king for a day, those are the things that I would do.
Yeah, I funny enough, Glass-Steagall is a topic that's near and dear to my heart. I wrote a term paper in college. I want to say it was, I can't remember, 2003. And it was on the collapse of WorldCom. And through my research writing that paper, that's where I discovered Glass-Steagall. Now, I haven't revisited this topic, but one of the assertions that I made in the term paper, which my parents loved, they say they saved it. So if I wanted to go back, and they've got it saved somewhere. But one of the things I looked at was I didn't think that the whole WorldCom debacle was possible without the repeal of Glass-Steagall. And reading your book and reading that section on Glass-Steagall, I found it amusing because I feel like that is a perfect example of what we're talking about and the unintended consequences. And I remember how they sold it. It amazes me how everybody and their mother, every financial institution gets blamed for the financial crisis, but nobody wants to talk about the repeal of Glass-Steagall. And one of the things I've said on the radio show before is that it really is a perfect example of kind of the problems we're dealing with, because it wasn't a one-party issue. Right. That was passed, and Clinton signed the bill, and it was passed by a Republican Congress. So both parties, you know, had a part in that. And, you know, it's fascinating to me. You know, then you repeal it. Right. Which, like you pointed out, was in response to the Great Depression. And then surprise, surprise, 9 years later, we have another financial crisis. Do you think, this is a little bit off topic, but do you think the financial crisis would have unfolded in the way it did or been nearly as dramatic had they not repealed Glass-Steagall?
I think it certainly would have been more difficult. I think that was a problem. I think another bigger problem was eliminating leverage levels on investment banks, and that goes back to 2003, I believe. And you know, the banks basically went bust in order of leverage. And so, you know, you don't need 2,200 pages. What you need is, you know, fairly high capital levels and lower levels of leverage. You know, and that was something that the SEC got rid of for the investment banks.
In their infinite wisdom. And then bringing up the Glass-Steagall thing, which we've talked about on air many times before, one of the things I loved about it is we didn't have to have a department of Glass-Steagall, right? We didn't have to build, you know, a giant building to handle that regulation. It was just simply no, right? You can't do it. And it sort of boxed out the ability for lobbyists and to push the edges kind of skirt around the different parts of the law. And I couldn't agree with you more. I think it was a great piece of legislation. Now, again, off topic, and I'm just throwing them at you here randomly. But do you think that we need a reinstitution of Glass-Steagall, and do you think that's possible?
I think it would be a good thing. I think it's certainly preferable to Dodd-Frank.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hey, I can't tell you how much we appreciate you coming on and talking about the book. And for everybody listening, at risk of going on and on about it, I just think it is an extremely important read. I think it's something that everybody needs to pay attention to. I do believe this problem has gotten malignant. And, I know you've referenced that other people were talking about it, but you were the first, the guy that I heard screaming this from the rooftops. And I can't thank you enough for coming on. And we wish you all the best of luck. And hopefully the book just is a absolute blockbuster for you. And we're cheering you on here from our corner of Seattle.
Well, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure. And, look forward to staying in touch.
All right, Jonathan. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And for those of you just listening, this is Jonathan Tepper, The Myth of Capitalism, new book out. Go get it. Very important read. And thanks again for joining us. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
Thanks for listening to Know Your Risk Radio. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Schedule your free risk review at knowyourriskradio.com. Tune in next week to Know Your Risk Radio with your host, Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.